DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme, unknown territory as France goes to the polls.
There are many ponderables, aren't there, in this? I mean, we don't know what Macron's going to do. I mean, Macron, with this dissolution, he's become a very unpredictable political animal. We don't know what he's capable of now.
And the political script is flipped in the UK as well.
The UK and Belarus are the only two countries in Europe that use first-past-the-post. And perhaps at this election, we're seeing why.
Then, Green Danube, balancing security with ecology from the Black Forest to the Black Sea. That's all coming up. That is the sound of ASMR electioneering. Yes, the French legislative election is full of surprises, not least that it's happening at all. This weekend, just 3 weeks after Emmanuel Macron responded to his party's humiliating defeat in the EU Parliament elections by dissolving the French National Assembly, France is going to the polls in the first round of a vote which could well see Jordan Bardella of Marine Le Pen's far-right National Rally Party installed as Prime Minister. How on earth did it come to this? I asked our Paris correspondent, John Laurenson, to remind me.
Well, because of the extraordinary decision of Emmanuel Macron to dissolve Parliament after the candidate wearing his colours was beaten by a very large margin by the candidate of the Rassemblement National, Jordan Bardella, in the European elections just 3 weeks ago. It was an extraordinary decision. It caught everyone by surprise because he really didn't have to do this. All he had to do was say, you know, these were elections to the European Parliament, no bearing on national politics, it's all business as usual, and move on. But instead, he chose to recognise what is, by the way, the truth, which is that his camp did badly in those elections because people are fed up with his government, and take this huge gamble. What he said was that French politics needed a clarification after that big win by Jordan Bardella. I think what he was hoping was that both the left and the right were too divided among themselves and too extreme also to win over voters.
Was his calculation correct?
Well, I think it was when it came to the right. Les Républicains, the traditional kind of centre-right party of government, led by Eric Ciotti, immediately announced that they would be going into alliance with the Rassemblement National. And this caused an outcry among all of the very well-known leaders of this party. So what you got there is you've got Les Républicains, who are going to field independent candidates against the Rassemblement National, and you've got a bunch, much smaller bunch, around Ciotti, who are going to field candidates in support of the Rassemblement National. Also, there's another very small, comparatively small, right-wing party, rather more right-wing than the Rassemblement National, called Reconquête, and they've pretty much crumbled.
Ah, now this is interesting, isn't it? Because you've got two key figures in this party, right? You've got Éric Zemmour, but his number two is one Marion Maréchal, formerly Marion Maréchal Le Pen.
Absolutely. So she is Marine Le Pen's niece. She used to be a Rassemblement National MP. She left the party in order to join Éric Zemmour because she hoped that Zemmour would head a new broad right-wing coalition. That political gamble on her behalf doesn't seem to have come off. And so Marion Maréchal, she said that she was supporting Jordan Bardella. She said she was supporting the Rassemblement National, provoking a rift with Zemmour. So basically on the right, you've got both of the other right-wing parties a split about what to do about the Rassemblement National. On the left, on the other hand, although you've got a great array of parties going from the quite far left a revolutionary party called La France Insoumise, headed by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who has spoken in glowing terms of, you know, Hugo Chavez's regime in Venezuela, for example, whose party's support for the Palestinian cause makes them, you know, very uncritical of Hamas, for example. So you've got this party, and you've got the socialists, who are much more centre-left, had a rather successful European election with about 13% of the vote, actually did rather better than the France Insoumise. These two parties should be irreconcilable. In record time, they signed an electoral deal along with the Green Party. And so there, Macron's gamble very much didn't pay off. The left has got its electoral act together. It's, you know, the centre-left has just forgotten about any problems it had with La France Insoumise, and they're all ready to field just one candidate in every constituency in the country. So they could actually do quite well. And the polls are showing that they are polling pretty well. They're at 29% behind the Rassemblement National's 34%.
So in that case, John, what are the potential scenarios that we're looking at coming out of these elections?
So three possibilities. The Rassemblement National winning an overall majority. And in that case, they will go into what the French call a cohabitation, with Macron being president. Macron, by the way, although he was very quick to dissolve parliament after the European elections, the national parliament after the European elections, he has said that he's not going to call a new presidential election. He's going to stay in the Élysée Palace. And so we're looking at the possibility of cohabitation with a leader of the very conservative right, or a leader from the left. If Jordan Bardella, the Rassemblement National, does not win an overall majority, just a relative majority, then Bardella has said, I just won't be able to govern properly, so I'm not going to become prime minister. In that case, there would be a political crisis, because I don't know how the French could form a government, really. What coalition could possibly put forward a prime minister who could govern effectively? There are many ponderables, aren't there, in this? I mean, we don't know what Macron's going to do. I mean, Macron, with this dissolution, he's become a very unpredictable political animal. We don't know what he's capable of now. He may decide to be constructive. He may continue with this idea that Bardella represents a movement which is anti-democratic, which is anti-human rights even. I think on the Rassemblement National, I think if they do win an overall majority, they will probably play it a little bit like Giorgia Meloni is playing it in Italy, which is to try and convince everyone how moderate and responsible they are. So he will probably play the game of cohabitation with Macron. As to what politics they will push through, they very recently came up with a manifesto for these elections, and they've divided what they're going to do should they win power into two categories. One, straight away, two, further down the line.
And further down the line, John, sorry, is presumably post-2027, when the presidential elections will be held, and they are hoping that we will be under then President Le Pen.
Exactly. There are a number of things which will be difficult to for the Rassemblement National to do constitutionally without having the president of the same political persuasion.
Give me some of the headlines from that second phase, because that, I think, is telling in terms of understanding the long game.
We have some meat on the bones when it comes to this phrase, préférence nationale, national preference. This is a real marker. What the Rassemblement National proposing is that instead of all people in the territory of France are being treated the same, if they are French nationals, then they're going to have certain privileges as regards people who are foreign nationals. And so when it comes to the distribution of some public services, social housing, for example, then the French will go to the top of the queue.
Liberté, égalité, fraternité, but only if you have the right passport. Our Paris correspondent, John Laurenson, there. For more background on the situation in France, we recommend our Focus on France special featuring French journalist and Fixing France author Nabila Ramdani. You'll find it on our usual podcast feeds. To the UK now, where elections are also afoot. And if polls are correct, the July 4th ballot could be taking Britain into uncharted territory as well, with that stalwart of British politics, the Conservative Party, headed for electoral disaster, if not oblivion. If that happens, it will rewrite the British electoral map and challenge a first-past-the-post system predicated on the dominance of the Conservative Party on the right and the Labour Party on the left. For smaller parties, this could represent the chance that they've been waiting for. Last week, Ashley Byrne took a look at the right-wing populist party Reform UK for us. This week, it's the turn of the Liberal Democrats.
Both main parties here in Britain are battling a scandal over betting. Rishi Sunak has withdrawn support from candidates being investigated for gambling on the date of the election, while the opposition leader, Keir Starmer, has suspended one of his candidates for betting on losing the seat he's fighting. And while it seems unlikely to dent Labour's huge lead, it's really not a good look for either big party, as they face a plague on both their houses from much of the electorate. Martin Baxter is the founder of Pollsters Electoral Calculus.
The total percentage support for Conservative and Labour combined is actually going down. The two big parties are less popular together than they used to be, and the smaller parties have become more popular.
And the big gainers in terms of seats are expected to be the Liberal Democrats, led by Ed Davey. They're a socially liberal centrist party in the UK, whose ancestors can be traced back to the 19th century. Passionately pro-EU, the Lib Dems were the biggest voice against Brexit in the referendum in 2016. In the 2019 election, in which Boris Johnson triumphed, their call for Britain to reverse Brexit failed, and they ended up with just 11 seats. But in this election, Ed Davey is the politician winning hearts, after opening up about his disabled son, who needs 24-hour care.
A lot depends on what carer help we've got, but I'm always involved in John's care. I like to be the one who gets John up in the morning, so he sees me, I get him up because he can't walk. Come on, my sweetheart, come on, we're going to have some lunch.
That does hit a particular chord with me because my grandma needs full care needs, and that's my auntie's responsibility, but when she's away, I do respite care. So I help dress Manor and give her medications and generally look after her. But I do think even for non-carers, it is endearing in a way to see, especially like someone of such political prominence, if you like, to see him take such good care of his son and his family.
It's the first time 20-year-old Heather Smith has been old enough to vote in a UK general election. She lives in the northwest England seat of Hazel Grove, and the kind of voter the Lib Dems need to wrestle the seat from the Conservatives. Meanwhile, 560 kilometres away, at the southernmost tip of the British mainland, is Penzance in Cornwall. This coastal town was a Lib Dem stronghold for decades, but Ed Davey's party were punished in 2015 for going into coalition with the centre-right Conservatives. Stacey Guthrie was born and grew up in the area.
What the Lib Dem candidates tended to have was that it seemed that they were more interested in serving the local community than they were about getting into power. And I think that's what shocked everybody when they went into coalition, and it lost them a lot of support, which was really unfortunate for people like Andrew George. It really lost him his seat, because up until that point, you had genuinely felt safe with Andrew.
9 years later, and the electorate in seats like this finally seemed prepared to forgive the party. And despite polling just 10 to 13% across the UK, all the signs are ruthless targeting could net the Lib Dems a record number of seats and may even see them replacing the Conservatives as the official opposition. But due to the disproportionate electoral system known as first past the post, it's unlikely to reap the same kind of rewards for other smaller parties. Here's political analyst Professor Rob Ford from the University of Manchester.
The party that's been making the most news is Reform UK, which is the party of Nigel Farage. It's a populist radical right party. It's quite similar to that kind of party we see all over Europe. But Reform UK's problem is, unlike those other European parties, they may well get many millions of votes in this election, perhaps almost as many votes as the governing Conservative Party, but they won't get many seats because they'll end up coming second or third almost everywhere. And under our system, second or third gets you nothing.
And what about the Greens?
the Greens are likely to have their best ever election in British politics too, in terms of votes. But they also have the same problem of a spread out vote. There are just a few seats where they're really concentrated, Bristol, Brighton, a couple of other places where they might take seats, but it won't be anywhere near the proportional to the vote they get.
With such vagaries, it seems highly likely some people will be scratching their heads after the vote. Here's Steve Gilmore from the all-party pressure group Make Votes Matter, which wants electoral reform.
The UK and Belarus are the only two countries in Europe that use first-past-the-post. And perhaps at this election, we're seeing why. What we can expect to see is one of, if not the most, distorted election result in history and the relationship between votes cast and seats won by the parties will be as unrepresentative, as inaccurate as potentially it's ever been. The latest model that I saw had Reform winning 15.5% and six MPs out of 650.
So come July the 5th, the day after the election, many voters could be seriously questioning the long-term sustainability of a system designed for a duopoly in an increasingly multi-party landscape. This is Ashley Byrne for DW on the election trail in the UK.
Just a quick reminder here of our feedback address, insideeurope@dw.com. Expect more from France and the UK next week. For now, though, we're heading east just after the break. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. In recent decades, the Danube region has made significant progress in enhancing collaboration and fostering closer ties. The process of European integration along the Danube is advancing, aiming to have the river serve as a unifying factor for all EU nations. That was the opening of the Declaration of Danube Foreign Ministers issued at the end of the 12th Danube Forum on June 20th. But how to balance the competing needs of ecology and security in a region which stretches from Germany in the west through to Ukraine in the east? Laura Kabelka was at the forum to find out for us.
The Danube Region Forum is an annual event where politicians and civil society discuss the EU strategy for a region home to around 115 million people. This year, it was Austria's turn to host. This strategy is part of cohesion policy, which makes up a third of the EU budget and aims to reduce disparities between regions. The Danube region is very diverse, spanning 14 countries between the Black Forest and the Black Sea. Interestingly, it's not only EU member states like Germany, Romania or Austria, but also candidate countries including Ukraine and Serbia that are part of this region. So it makes sense that the topics enlargement, security and stability are very high on the agenda.
We want stability, we want security and we want prosperity for this Danube region.
This was Austria's Foreign Minister Alexander Schallenberg. Before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine brought war to a country in this region, security and defense were not a big concern. Now, this shift in priorities has to be reflected in the budget. War, however, is not the only existential threat that needs to be mitigated.
It will be essential for our survival that we deal with the issues of climate change. Therefore, renaturation, for instance, is an important issue, also following the EU's decision.
This was Vienna's Mayor Michael Ludwig, who stressed the importance of projects such as flood mitigation through renaturalization of floodplains along the Danube River. Ludwig also called for social housing on an EU level, for which Vienna is regarded as a best practice example. So building prosperity and protecting the environment are also main goals of the region and cohesion policy in general. But now the question is, how can the EU be green, prosperous and secure? And let's not forget that the debt raised during the pandemic needs to be paid back as well. The EU budget is a matter of intense negotiations. Currently, we're in the midst of the multi-annual financial framework. That's what the EU's long-term budget is called. It covers the period 2021 to 2027. But with a view to enlargement and security concerns, the next budget is already being debated. Johannes Hahn, the current EU budget commissioner, is calling for a larger budget.
The current budget is about 1% of the European GDP. We have to invest in competitiveness and in security. And in my view, this cannot be covered by this famous 1% limitation. The European budget is not flexible enough to respond to new developments, which you cannot foresee at the beginning of a seven-year cycle. And in reality, the discussion about it starts much earlier, like this time.
So what possibilities are there to increase the budget? And how likely is this to happen? I talked to Niels Redeker, the deputy director and budget policy expert of the Jacques Delors Center, an EU think tank in Berlin. He laid out several ways in which the EU could raise revenue.
First, there are member state contributions. So the member states could just send more money to Brussels. Second, you could increase EU level own resources. So basically introduce new EU taxes. And third, that, of course, is an option. In the end, we will probably need a mix of things.
According to Redeker, there's a worry that countries will try to contribute as little as possible to the joint budget. Also, the recent European elections resulted in a shift to the right in the European Parliament. How could this affect budget talks?
I think the election results in the European Parliament, I don't think they will have a large impact on the debate about the budget. The center in the European Parliament held, and the Parliament generally has an interest in a bigger budget. The bigger repercussions are going to be in the European Council and what national governments make of these results.
It's still relatively early in the discussion, and it's not clear how each member state will position themselves. French President Macron, for one, has pushed ahead and called for a doubling of the budget. Other heads of state have been less vocal. The Commission will publish its proposal for the next long-term budget around summer next year. Laura Kabelka, DW.
And if you want to test your Danube trivia, boy, do we have the quiz for you. If you head on over to Spotify and open up this week's edition of the programme, you will find that our weekly quiz is a whack-a-mole type of extravaganza where you get to click on any country where the Danube River runs through. Have fun with that. Oh yeah, and the answer to last week's quiz question about the official mascot for the Euro 2024 games was Albert the teddy bear, though personally I do think that Gunther the Gnu from Gelsenkirchen could have been a winner. Inside Europe is of course also available on all the other usual platforms, and that includes YouTube via DW's podcast channel. There you will also find our sister programme Living Planet, which brings you weekly environment stories in three new formats. So, first format, to answer your environmental questions, they have episodes that ask what's better. Questions like what's better for the environment, coffee or tea, paper books or e-readers, glasses or contact lenses. In their deep dive episodes, Living Planet go all out on issues like farmers' mental health and the global illegal bushmeat trade to bring you the facts and debates about important and emerging environmental issues. And finally, there is their Naturally Connected series, which is where they zoom in on one place, plant or animal. You can find all of those new formats of Living Planet on your favourite podcast app. You are listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Thank you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Now, here is something that we have been saving up for a rainy day, or as is now more likely in a European summer in the year 2024, a scorching hot day. Welcome to the first instalment of a series we're calling Other Europes. Basically, the idea is this. As a counterpoint to our weekly current affairs reporting, or dispatches from the permacrisis, as I sometimes think of it, we've created a space for stories that provide windows onto the myriad people, projects and places that represent Europe at its most generous, most inclusive and most hopeful. Together, we hope that these stories provide a glimpse of a European future which is still possible. It has to be, because it already exists. One thing that we noticed when we started collecting these stories is that most of them, in one way or another, were about belonging. In the case of our first story, that's particularly clear. It comes to us from the Italian city of Bologna, a medieval university town with a reputation for progressive values. Whilst Italy, under far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, has pursued an anti-migrant agenda, curtailing migrants' special protection and cracking down on residence permits, Bologna has taken a different tack. As a city, Bologna has replaced ius sanguinis, the right of blood, with ius soli, the right of the soil. That means that any child born in Bologna is considered a Bolognese citizen, irrespective of where their parents originally came from. It's a simple but radical idea, and one which our Bologna-based reporter, Danny Mitzman, was all too happy to investigate for us.
If you come to Piazza Maggiore, Bologna's central square, and look up at the old town hall, you'll see a huge red banner across the top of the main entrance that says Bolognesi dal primo giorno, Bolognese from the first day. When Matteo Lepore was elected mayor in 2021, this was, he says, an essential part of his vision. Within a matter of months, the council had voted to amend the municipal charter, granting honorary citizenship to all children of non-Italian parents resident in Bologna.
We have a million of people in our country that pay taxes, they work in our cities, they contribute to our community, but they can't vote. So it's difficult to say to these people that their son or daughter are not Italians.
There is a paradox in ius sanguinis. Even if you've never set foot in Italy, don't speak the language, but have an Italian parent, you can get automatic citizenship and be able to vote, while someone who's lived here all their life can't. So the motivation behind the amendment is simple.
The idea that everyone who arrives in Bologna or grew up in Bologna has the right to be citizens of our town, so we call Bolognese from the first day, or Italian. It's also a campaign for citizenship. So the idea that Bologna, as a progressive city, promote a national campaign for citizenship and a new law in the parliament.
Something which the mayor says is a long way off.
Italy is scared by the people from other countries, especially from Africa or Asia. The color of the skin is an institutional racism. And the far right is so present in the culture of the country and the institutional system. And also the left, the center left, when they had the opportunity to reform the law, they didn't.
According to statistics published by Save the Children, there are more than 870,000 school children in Italy who don't hold citizenship, around 70% of whom were born here. That's why the Bolognese Amendment specifies another concept, ius scolae, the right of school.
The Bolognese ius soli, as I call, is a mix of ius soli and ius scolae, because we are open to the people who arrive in the city, but also the people born in the city. If a young person has the idea that Italy will be his future, I think he will invest on our country and not think that it's the council that don't want him or her.
La questione è che abbiamo oggi andremo a creare un inchiostro che una volta si utilizzava.
An after-school club on the outskirts of the city. Although it's open to anyone, almost all the kids who come here for free activities, a snack and help with their homework are from immigrant families.
My name is Isha and I'm 15 years old and I was born in Pakistan. I'm come in 2019 in Italy.
Isha's father's been in Italy for 20 years and has applied for citizenship, but is still waiting.
Nella mia classe c'è 5 marocchini, 3 albanesi.
Listing the different nationalities in her class, she says some have citizenship, while others, like her, don't.
In Italia c'è ancora il razzismo.
In Italy, there's still racism, and they still don't trust people with different citizenship from them.
14-year-old Gorshan was born in Bologna to Indian parents.
My father moved here 20 years ago, my mother 16 years ago.
Gorshan obtained Italian citizenship last year.
In my opinion, it's not fair. If you're born in France, even if your parents are foreign, you're considered French. I think the same should happen in Italy and other countries.
Ciao, io sono Arish.
I'm Arish. I'm 17 years old. I was born here in Bologna.
When his parents were granted Italian citizenship, Arish was able to request it too and became a citizen 2 years ago.
When I had to go anywhere, I would always automatically get asked for my residency permit, and it still happens to me now, because everyone thinks that if you don't look Italian, you must have a residency permit because you can't be Italian. But I think you should be Italian if you were born here. We are in 2024, and the laws can't stay as they were. They need to change. They should give citizenship to people born here and not make them wait years to get it.
Young people whose parents aren't citizens currently have a one-year window when they turn 18 to apply for citizenship. The process is riddled with bureaucratic complexities and potential obstructions, which Matteo Lepore considers institutionalized racism.
I think it's a very long trip to arrive at the end of the process. You have to ask the citizenship at 18, but the reply arrived 5-6 years after. So it's very, very long. It's not incentivated. And I think a right is a right. If you have a right, you have to obtain the right in the moment, not after 6 years.
In casa tua si è mai parlato di permesso di soggiorno per poter stare in un paese?
Since launching the campaign, the city's organised events, inviting musicians, activists, actors, writers and influencers to discuss the theme. Although Bolognese citizenship is symbolic, the mayor says it can still help sensitise the whole community, raising awareness of the demographically outdated law and the evolution of Italian society. Danny Mitzman, DW, Bologna.
Grazie soprattutto al Comune di Bologna!
Now, what better way to foster a sense of belonging in the community than to open up a new culture centre? Yeah, you'd think, right? But when Centre Rog opened in the Slovenian capital Ljubljana recently, the evening was accompanied by riot police, tear gas, eggs, graffiti and vandalism. It's all because of a clash over what culture and creativity should be. Autonomous, but dirty and somewhat intimidating, like the squat which was previously in the old Rog bike factory, or clean and, on the face of it, accessible, like the new Centre Rog, which is controlled by the city. Here's our ever open-minded Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay, with more.
If this sounds like a neighbourhood picnic, that's because it is. But the venue is a little unusual. We're in front of what used to be the largest bike factory in Yugoslavia. The business, Rog Bicycles, didn't survive Slovenia's declaration of independence in the early 90s, but the building on Ljubljana's riverside remained, and at the end of last year, it reopened in a new guise, Centre Rog. Now it houses a range of workshops, studios, and even a library, all aimed at anyone who wants to be creative. And this Neighbours Day aims to introduce it to the local community.
Our 9 production labs will facilitate amateur makers, but also professional designers and creators.
Renata Zamida is the center's director general.
We aspire to be the creative engine of the city and even broader, facilitating the ones who want to create and bring their ideas into products in various fields of, let's say, handicraft to very advanced technologies.
So basically, these are like table lamps.
And production has returned to this former industrial facility. Lighting designer Matej Stefanac is among the creators who are enjoying up to 3 years rent-free in Centerog Studios. He says the facilities make all the difference to people like him.
The whole space, including the labs, is going to allow me to build prototypes faster than I would be able to do without it. That means I can use it, the metal lab, to make some metal parts and test them out fast.
But not everybody was happy about the transformation of the old building. Towards the end of last year, the opening night of Centerog was a study in contrasts. Inside, the invited guests strolled through the new facilities, sipping sparkling wine. Outside, a disgruntled crowd banged drums and threw eggs at the glass facade. They were angry that the city authorities had evicted a squat known as Autonomous Factory ROG to clear the way for the new creative centre.
The opening of the Centerog produced an almost Kafkaesque festival of the two Ljubljanas. One that was drinking champagne in the glass annex, overlooking the other, protesting outside in the cold.
Miloš Košec is a professor of architecture and a campaigner against gentrification in Ljubljana. He says the evicted squat was a major loss to the city.
The autonomous factory ROG was a really interesting social experiment, enabling spaces for people working, creating stuff that they wouldn't have found anywhere else in the city, helping the population that would have been pushed out already to have a place in this city.
Back on opening night, the soundtrack was suitably industrial, courtesy of Stroy Machine, a band who make their own instruments. The music reflected the conflict between the different visions for the old bike factory, a dispute which rumbles on, even though Centerog is now up and running. So, can the two sides ever be reconciled? Both Renata Zamida and Miloš Košec are optimistic.
I hope that we will be able to show in the future that we are a very, very open institution and that everyone can come to us.
We need the ROG factory in one way or another, but we need it in a specific way, in a way that it will make creative life in this city better, not worse.
So perhaps for Centerog, there will eventually be a creative solution. Guy Delaunay, DW, Ljubljana.
Time to shake off your hangover now as we swap the night owls of Ljubljana for the early birds of Sheffield. Warning, as Inside Europe stories go, this one is probably just about as wholesome as it gets. Our reporter Lucy Taylor has been joining a group of nursery children for a sing-along. Nothing newsworthy there, you might be thinking, but listen closely because all may not be quite as it seems.
So are we ready? In and out the dusty bluebells, in and out the dusty bluebells, in and out the dusty bluebells, will you be my partner?
For these 3 and 4 year olds, it's an everyday sing-along. But if you listen closely, you might hear some different voices joining in.
Should we do it a bit faster?
In and out the dusty bluebells, in and out the dusty bluebells, in and out the dusty bluebells. The children have taken playtime out of their usual classroom, along the road, and into the lounge at the care home around the corner.
And they're old people too.
It was the idea of the nursery's manager, Emily Steele.
We're a nursery in Sheffield, and we really do believe that all the social skills are the foundations for them being able to learn and regulate their emotions, and they learn so much for being out in the big wide world. So we wanted to build that and bring some happy to the residents at the nursing home too. So we've set up this really lovely relationship, and now we're going there every Monday.
Old MacDonald had a farm, E-I-E-I-O.
This week is one of the best so far. About 10 residents have come to join in. They're sitting in lounge chairs around the circle of children on the floor.
I mean, the nursing home have fed back to us that they're getting more residents down there than they expected, which is really nice. But then we've also had weeks where we've had residents who the care workers have been really surprised at because they've come to life and they've done all this joining in that they've never seen them do.
And on that farm he had a
lamb.
What does a lamb sound like?
They hope that mixing the generations can help the children to understand the world better and give the older people a connection to their community and something to look forward to.
They love it, yeah. They're talking about it all week after they've been, and the kids are teaching them songs and even sign language and things.
Catherine Ferris is the manager at the care home.
Having a really good turnout, to be honest. We've got quite a few people that historically were teachers, so they really enjoy having the children come in. Quite a lot of people who grew up in the local area, so they've lived in Totley all their lives, so they're just really keen to, you know, see the children that are growing up in the area as well. So, yeah, it's really nice. It's one of our most popular activities.
What do you think about having the children here? Have you enjoyed it?
Lovely. Yes, every time they come. We love seeing them, yes. Yes, we all enjoy it as well, yeah. Yes. Yes, we all enjoy it, definitely. Look forward to them coming.
Wind the bobbin up, wind the bobbin up, pull, pull, clap, clap, clap.
And even with so many former teachers, it's not just the children who are learning. The class are teaching their new older friends sign language and new songs and showing them all the other things they've found out about the world.
I think that's the beautiful thing about children this age. They just want to play. They don't care if you're 75 or 5. They just want to get to know you. Last week when we went, we took our caterpillars that were growing and they were walking around giving all the residents high fives, showing them the caterpillars, chatting away. They're just so unfazed. They're just such a beautiful age to bring some happiness to somebody's day.
The groups hope their pioneering project will show everyone that you're never too old for new friends. Lucy Taylor, DW, in the UK.
Bye-bye, Mrs.
Bye-bye, Mrs. But if you want to hear more from Lucy Taylor, then do check out the newly released second series of the award-winning investigative podcast, Buried. This is Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Now, the summer holidays are almost upon us and accommodation is filling up fast. If you're worried about the environmental impact of your travels, then you could, of course, check into an eco-campsite with a compost loo. And I am not knocking that, by the way, because that really is my idea of a good holiday. If, however, you are determined to keep the full luxury of a relaxing hotel break, then the Spanish Iberostar Hotel Group has good news for you. It's installed AI in its dustbins. Now, just how that will help reduce the climate impact of your holiday is something that our correspondent, Ashish Sharma, has been finding out for us.
It's a busy scene in the kitchen of the Iberostar Selection Playa de Palma Hotel here in Mallorca. Chef Irene is discarding leftover potatoes, carrots and other vegetables. Her number two in the kitchen is Andres.
We want to throw the pineapple in the bin, and the machine cap the photos and the kilos.
As he opens the bin and throws in the peels from pineapples, the AI, which sits just above the dustbin, takes a photo. Its algorithms are designed to identify over 600 different types of food. Iberostar's head of climate change and decarbonization, Alvaro Sanchez, explains that the system called Winnow can also weigh the amount of food that has just been dumped.
It measures every time that you put anything inside the basket, you know,
it weights it. And then if you add something else, again, you know, so you have the difference. It identifies what is the product, the type of waste that you are rejecting, and knows the weight of that, you know.
Right.
Now, one of the main purposes of WeKno is to identify clearly what kind of food waste we have in order to reduce it. I mean, it's not, we are not measuring just for the sake of measuring it. You know, we want to know what we are rejecting the most so we can adjust the menus and, you know, just do things better.
Iberostar is using this technology in all its hotels in Spain as it strives to fulfill its pledge to not only decrease its carbon footprint, but to reduce to zero all landfill waste by the year 2025. Quite simply, by being able to identify the food that is thrown away and in which meals during the day, this can help the hotel group make prudent choices about its menus and the products that it purchases. This in turn helps reduce food waste and make the hotel more sustainable, as well as reducing its costs.
This station is Bank. Change here.
The WeKno system is designed by the company with the same name, which is based in London.
David Jackson, Director of Marketing and Public Affairs at WeKno. It's the same type of technology that you find in a driverless car. So the field of AI that we work in is computer vision. And effectively what we're doing is we're teaching a machine to see the food that's being thrown away. Now, why would you want to do that? Food waste is an age-old problem for the hospitality sector. Chefs don't want to throw food away, but it's really difficult to measure. So by using cutting-edge technology, we're able to make it easy and seamless to record the food that's being thrown away and then give teams insights that help them to pinpoint waste areas and then eventually cut that food waste in half. Food waste is incredibly intensive from an environmental perspective because when food waste goes into landfill, it creates methane. Methane can be up to 80 times more potent as a greenhouse gas versus carbon dioxide. And so the message we're getting from the market is this meets our needs from a sustainability perspective because we need to reduce our overall carbon footprint, but it's also driving cost savings. So IKEA, for example, has deployed WeKno across all of their stores in over 32 countries. They reported savings of over $37 million since the 2017 baseline, which is a great proof point that really this is the right thing to do for both people, planet and profit.
Back at the selection Playa de Palma, Alvaro is keen to point out that the hotel isn't only using the WeKno's technology in order to reduce its waste and carbon footprint.
More than 75% of our carbon footprint comes from our suppliers, you know, from the products that are entering our hotels and also from the products that are exiting our hotels. So we need to engage with the supply chain in order to help them decarbonize. Okay, we want to be sourced of sustainable product. Only if we do that, you know, we will be able to decarbonize fully.
I was in one of your restaurants earlier on and I could see on the menu there was fish, for example. That's not come from, you know, you're an island, you've got sea all around you, you've got fish all around you. But actually the fish that was on the menu came from the north of Europe. That doesn't make sense.
Well, you have to approach, you have to tackle the challenges step by step. Okay, the priority at the beginning was to make sure that all the fish that we were buying, you know, purchasing, was certified as sustainable. Now we are moving into ensuring that we are purchasing as local as possible. When you want to buy local, it might not be so easy to obtain the certificate. You know what I mean? So now we are transitioning into something that is much more complex, you know, and just having a more holistic view of the products that we are using in the hotels.
Artificial intelligence in the tourism sector has many uses. In the case of Iberostar, it's helping them reduce food waste, their carbon footprint, and as a result, their overheads. The technology has been employed for more than a year, and the hotel group claims it's reduced food waste by 11% in that time. But the wider issue regarding the supply chain and the sourcing of food means the hotel industry still has many strides to make to become wholly sustainable, and it remains to be seen if AI will be used in these areas in the years to come. Ashish Sharma, DW, Mallorca.
I am reluctant for my Mediterranean holiday to end, so let's prolong it just a little bit longer with the inspiring story of Lefteris Arapakis, co-founder of Enalia, the Mediterranean cleanup project which teaches sustainable fishing techniques to local fishermen, thereby tackling, and pun yes intended, the problems of plastic pollution, overfishing and unemployment all at once. Here he is in this piece, which we first broadcast back in 2022.
So when Alia started a few years ago, when the Greek economic crisis reached a peak, it was back then with the capital controls when unemployment had exploded at 29%. At that time, I really wanted to do something about that, to do something to help create jobs. I was just finishing university, and I remember I was discussing with my father about that topic. And then he told me that they couldn't find enough personnel for the fishing boats. And, you know, I just answered, just go to fishing school and get people from there. And this is when he told me that there is no fishing school in the country. So I researched the topic, and I talked with a friend, and I told him, you know, would you like maybe to start the first school for fishing in Greece? So this is how Enalia started, and Enalia actually means together with the fishermen. So we started the first school for professional fishing in the country. And over the last years, we have trained more than 130 unemployed people and created more than 100 jobs in the sector. So we started studying all the latest papers regarding marine plastic pollution. And then we read that by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the sea. So we realized that there is no use getting there more fishermen if we don't do something about that. So we decided to act, and we started with a small pilot from our local port here in Piraeus. And there we did something very simple. Just we trained my father, some of his friends, to just bring back the plastic that they were collecting. And they started to collect actually vast amounts of plastic in their nets, bringing it back in the port every night. And then we saw that a lot of this plastic was not coming only from Greece, but from other Mediterranean countries as well. And we realized that in our case, it's actually a Mediterranean challenge rather than a national challenge. So this is why we decided to create a new project, which we call the Mediterranean Cleanup. And with the Mediterranean Cleanup, over the last 2.5 years, we are training fishing communities to fish for plastic. Currently, we are working with 1,300 fishers in the Mediterranean Sea, and we are collecting more than 5,000 kilos of plastic from the bottom of the sea weekly. You know, of course, the problem is too big, like plastic pollution, climate change. They are global, universal challenges, to be honest. So it's easy to get overwhelmed by these kind of challenges. So my philosophy in that is that we should focus on what we can actually change and not focus on what we cannot change. Like, for example, I cannot change marine plastic pollution. I cannot change climate change. It takes millions or billions of people to do that. But what I can do is I can first change my own behavior, and then I can change the behavior of the people around me. And, you know, we started small. We started with three fishermen, and now we are working with more than 1,600 fishermen in the Mediterranean Sea and the Indian Ocean. And, you know, I'm a young person coming from a fishing family from Piraeus, can motivate thousands of fishers to collect plastic from the seas and the oceans, you know, then each and every one of you can make a difference by motivating their own community, farmers, teachers, students, politicians, to actually make a change. I believe that we should focus on what we can change, and then we can actually change the things that we couldn't before.
And with that, we've reached the shores of the programme. This programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with help from Nick Martin and sound engineer Thomas Schmidt. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.